started on that, I want to give you a list of a few references that you might take a look at over the next couple of weeks. And then I want to give you a rough outline of what we're going to do this week and next. So I'm co-teaching this course with Natalia Toro, and we'll hand off next week. But I'll be teaching this week. Okay, so we're going to study the standard model, and because the standard model is really our best quantum field theory, and a couple of references that I will use throughout this course is a text by Donahue, Golowich, and Holstein. Let me just write these out here. I think all of these you can find in the library. I haven't actually verified, but I think they're all there. So dynamics of the standard model. Pierre Ramond wrote a very nice text, which I suggest you take a look at. So journeys beyond standard model. I'll also be using, and I think these are posted on the, there's a wiki for this class, right? Okay, I haven't looked at the wiki, but I'm confident it's there. And on it, I think you should find Michael Peskin's lecture notes from previous years teaching this course. Okay, so these are, I think these are just, I don't know what they're called. I'll just call them the Psi standard model lecture notes. And finally, Weinberg's series of textbooks on quantum field theory. Okay, so QFT 1 and 2 in particular. Okay. Now, in broad outline, I think I don't think everybody's back from break yet, at least so I was told. Is that correct? Still a few people missing? Okay. So I thought today I would start with an overview of the basic building blocks of the standard model, just so that we can all get ourselves onto the same page. And I'll do that before going into field theory topics a little bit later this week. So let me just give you an outline for this week. So I don't know if I should call these lecture numbers, but so I'm going to start with an intro to the standard model. I'm going to, I don't want to call it review. I'm going to call it a sort of a reintroduction to quantum field theory, but from a fully modern point of view. I think everybody here has taken 2 3-week courses on quantum field theory. So most of what I'll talk about in here you will have seen before, but I'll present it from a completely different point of view. One that I think is much closer to the way that most of us think about it now. And it will make very sharp contact with the ingredients, with the particle content of the standard model, and trying to make a theory of interactions of those particles that is fully Lorentz invariant and quantum mechanical. Okay, and then after we do that, we'll spend quite a bit of time then looking at effective field theories. And we'll look at effective field theories that are relevant in quantum electrodynamics, the weak interactions, and the strong interactions. Now here I think you may have made contact with effective field theories in the courses. Is the Euler-Heisenberg Lagrangian or nonlinear sigma models or Fermi's model, any of these ring a bell? Or okay, so that's great. So we can do that for the first time here, and I think we'll have quite a bit of fun with these. And then this will take us into next week. And I think after we cover topics in field theory and effective field theories, we'll come back to the standard model as a specific field theory next week and look at it in considerable detail. I mean, I will tell you exactly what it is this week, but we're not going to break it down. Now, I should start by also mentioning some conventions, just to make sure that there's, because if I don't say this now, I won't say it later, and it may be confusing. But throughout this course, and this may have been the case in your quantum field theory course, I will be working in units where h bar and c are set to 1, okay? These are so-called natural units. I will also be working in the mostly negative metric convention when I'm talking about relativistic quantities. Okay. Now, so did you guys discuss natural units in your first two field theory courses? Okay, well, just to refresh your memory, working in these units, of course, so we just recall that the speed of light is length over time. H bar is energy times time. So I can use H bar and C to swap, to go back and forth between energy and length scales. So for example, in these units, a length scale, right, is just the speed of light times a time scale, but I'm working in units where the speed of light is 1. So the dimensions of length and time are the same. And of course, I can use, I'll put C here, and I can use H bar C's, or powers of them, to relate length scales and time scales to energy scales. Okay? So length and time are inverse energy and inverse momentum scales. Now, I want to remind you of this because even today I'll start going back and forth between centimeters and GeV inverse, and it can be a little bit confusing unless you just stop and think for a second that what I'm doing is using natural units to go back and forth between these different scales. Okay. Now, just as a reference point, if you work in these units, a billion inverse electron volts, this is essentially the energy that an electron acquires through 1 volt of acceleration, is approximately 10 to the minus 24 seconds. And I said time and length have the same dimension. Well, this is approximately 2/10 of a Fermi meter. Okay. And just for fun, a JeV is approximately 10 to the minus 24 grams. Incidentally, a little micro black hole of a Planck mass is about a milligram. Okay. Now, I'm going to come back in a few lectures to talking about a kind of fully modern way of talking about particles, or at least what we mean when we talk about particles in nature. But at least for the purpose of this lecture, a particle is sort of what you would expect a particle to be. A particle state is something that carries a label of energy. It carries momentum. And it can also carry additional labels. So you've seen fermions. Fermions are particles that, in addition to carrying energy and momentum, also carry something called spin, or an intrinsic angular momentum. And particles may also carry other labels that go with them. Okay? And of course, one of the things that we use to label a particle is its mass. And here I'll just put intrinsic spin. Okay. Now I'm going to be very schematic in this lecture, mainly because I'll be talking about the particles of the standard model. These are the building blocks that will allow us to essentially formulate the fundamental laws of the standard model. But we don't need to get too formal yet. Now, one thing that is true is that these objects typically behave like they're localized in space when we see them. You all know about atoms. You know that you can fire laser light at atoms and you can knock electrons out, and the electrons hit your detector like they're little particles localized in space. Also, you can manipulate particles. You can collide them together. More particles come out. Okay? So the universe seems to be filled with these particles. We're built out of them. The interactions among them are the things that that we'll be interested in. Of course, you should ask why the universe is built out of things like this. So I'll come back to that in the third lecture. Now, all particles that we'll be talking about carry either integer or half-integer spin. And there's an important point here. So integer spin particles behave like bosons. Okay, so I think you've been introduced to Bose and Fermi statistics and field theory. So bosons are objects that commute with one another. Fermions are objects that anti-commute with one another, and they obey Pauli statistics, or they obey the Pauli exclusion principle. Okay, and half-integer spin particles behave like fermions. You should ask why. So, of course, one of the things that field theory has helped us understand is why this is actually true. Okay. So I think this was covered in field theory, but I want to come back to this from a different point of view a little bit later. But all the matter in the universe, the stuff we're made out of, is half integer fermions, okay, and forces involve integer spin bosons. Okay. So just to make sure that's clear, so these are things like, and I'll tell you in a second, electrons, muons, protons, etc. And forces involve things like the photon, the graviton, W and Z bosons. Okay. And those, and at least when they're massless, those can mediate long-range forces. Now, so far, I'm just summarizing facts that I'm sure you've all seen before. But one of the things we should try to do in this course is understand why this is true. They certainly appear true in experiments. Didn't have to be this way, at least to a good approximation. So, of course, how do we know all these things? Well, now I don't want to give a thorough treatment of particle detectors and particle experiments and go through a history of how we learned everything that we know about the Standard Model, but suffice it to say, there's sort of three main sources of knowledge, and that concerns just there's atoms, okay? Boy, this is an awful sketch of an atom, but now, the study of atoms turns out to give us a wealth of information about the Standard Model. I mean, incidentally, it was the study of atoms that led to the development of quantum mechanics and quantum field theory. Okay, just this was sort of, let's just say this picture of the world solidified in the 1930s. Another source of knowledge is looking at the properties of radioactive decay of atoms. So atoms with some number of protons and neutrons transitioning into an atom with some different number of protons and neutrons, and in the process it pops out particles. Okay. Incidentally, this could be like a neutron decaying into a proton plus an electron plus a neutrino. This is beta decay. Okay. So a great deal about the Standard Model can be learned just by staring at atoms, once you've understood atoms, and looking at how particles pop out of them when they decay. This was useful all the way up through the 1950s, and even into the early 1960s. But at least these days, the primary way that we learn about fundamental physics, the Standard Model, and quantum field theory at ultra-high energies is through collisions. We take these particles, these building blocks we discovered long ago, and we collide them at extremely high energies and probe extremely short distances in the process. Okay, so then there's collisions. Okay, and we typically collide things like electrons or protons, things that we're actually built out of that we can get a hold of readily. This is the typical thing that we do. So we'll collide electrons. Maybe we collide them with protons or electrons. And of course, and again, didn't have to be this way, but what we observe is every time you collide particles, you get out more particles, okay? But the way that you get out those particles, the patterns they behave and their interactions, their rates, those tell you something about the fundamental interactions, okay? Now, I didn't mention it, but another way that we actually, another source of information is cosmic rays. So before we could easily put together packets of particles and slide them and slam them into one another, a useful way of going to high energies and getting collisions was to just look at cosmic rays. We're bathed in cosmic rays, high energy charged particles, things like electrons and muons and protons, and those slam into air molecules and produce these showers. Well, we can study those and learn quite a bit from that. In fact, the muon was discovered in cosmic rays. Okay. Now, all of this is to say is that it's particles that we actually see, okay? That is what we're built out of. So that's the starting point that I want to take in, this course, okay? And so our goal should be to understand how you take particles as building blocks and do quantum mechanics with particles in a relativistically invariant way, all right? Now, before we do that, so that'll take us into the quantum field theory part of this course. But for the rest of the lecture today, I want to just introduce you to all of the ingredients. And I want to introduce you to sort of the modern picture of all the fundamental particles and their constituents. Okay, so I will go through this somewhat quickly. Let me pop this up. Oops. Okay, so we have leptons, we have quarks, and we have hadrons. Okay, and I want to let you know what all of these objects are. But when you look at the particle content of the Standard Model, probably the simplest objects to look at are what we call leptons. Okay, now there's six types of leptons. There's charged leptons. This is the electron, the muon, and the tau lepton. And these are spin 1/2 fermions. They carry electromagnetic charges. Weak charges. So they interact by electromagnetism and the weak forces. But no strong charges. Okay? The other three are, we call them neutrinos. There's, just like with the three charged leptons, there appear to be three neutral spin 1/2 fermions. Yeah, is there a question? Yeah. Okay. Now these are weakly interacting. They're not strongly interacting, so not strong. and they're neutral. Okay, now we don't know if these three leptons have distinct antiparticles. That is open to experimentation at this point. But for these three, we know they have antiparticles. They were discovered long ago, so we call them the positron but I'll group them with those. Now again, we should understand why these even exist, but I'll come back to that a little later. But I don't count them as separate species in this accounting. Okay. So basically the question of antineutrinos, this is open. Are these distinct? Are they the same? We don't know. But there's a whole series of experiments underway to help tell us whether or not there is a new species of neutrino that we could conceivably identify with an antineutrino that's distinct. Okay. Now, as far as we can tell, electrons, muons, and tau leptons are essentially all the same, except with their mass, okay? So the very lightest lepton is about half of an MeV, half a million electron volts. Okay, and because it's the lightest, it turns out to be stable. This I'm sure you know very well. Your life depends on it. There's muons that are considerably heavier than the electrons, but otherwise behave just the same way. And then there's the tau, which is the heaviest lepton of all. Now, these guys being heavier, turns out they can decay. And their decay properties contain a wealth of information about the underlying structure of the standard model. So in particular, let me put this up. So the muon, almost all the time, well, essentially all the time, decays to an electron and then actually two neutrinos. This has a lifetime of approximately 2 × 10⁻⁶ seconds, which means when this thing's traveling at the speed of light, it travels quite a distance. So this is why you can see things like muons and cosmic rays. Once you produce them, they actually live long enough that they can fly an appreciable distance. Okay. So just muons travel very far before decaying. So if I boost this, I can make them even travel kilometers. Okay. So in laboratory experiments and in cosmic rays, we see muons all the time. Okay. They might as well be stable in laboratory experiments. Now you should ask why, well, okay. You don't have a reference point at this point, but this is a very, very long time scale in fundamental physics. So you should ask, where does that time scale come from? Well, let's compare it to taus. So now taus also have a decay into lighter leptons. They have a decay into muons. They have a decay into electrons. But actually, these are small. They don't happen very often. Most of the time, the decay is into a tau neutrino plus, I haven't gotten to them yet, but strongly interacting particles called pions. And it turns out the lifetime is very, very small on the picosecond scale. So these particles you typically don't see in laboratory experiments. they only travel maybe at most a tenth of a millimeter or so. Maybe you can boost them so they travel a little bit longer. So not quite macroscopic. Now, it's not terribly deep trying to explain why this scale is so much faster than this scale. It, of course, will turn out that all of these decays are occurring through what we call weak interactions. It's just that the tau is heavy enough that it has many, many more states that it can decay into. Yeah. We don't know if they're distinct. Yeah. So there it really means, in that notation, that meant the conjugated state. Basically, it's this whole question of whether or not you have Majorana-like or Dirac-like neutrinos. This is something we might come back to in the third week. Okay, there's of course an entire industry of neutrino physics trying to understand neutrino masses, where they come from, and the structure of the neutrino sector, but we'll return to that topic later. Now, as far as we can tell, all of these leptons appear point-like. When you slam objects into them, when you slam other particles into them, either you slam photons into them or other charged leptons into them and try to resolve substructure, you can't resolve anything down to scales less than 10 to the minus 18 centimeters. But in natural units, as far as we can tell, things like, I'll just give you the value for the electron. The inverse length scale associated with, this really belongs up there, is larger than 10 TeV or so. Okay, so as far as we can tell, they appear point-like. Now, this isn't all the matter in the standard model. These are the only purely weakly interacting matter states in the standard model. There's a whole other set that we don't see, known as quarks. We don't see them directly because they're bound together. Well, let me not, I'm not going to talk about the quarks specifically. So quarks are spin half fermions. I'll tell you about them a little bit later, but essentially what appears to be the case is that all of the things that I'm about to tell you about right now, hadrons, which are composed of mesons and baryons, they're built out of constituent spin one half fermions that we call quarks, okay? But it's a property of the interactions that they're charged under that they end up confining at low energies. All right? But quarks are the constituents of mesons, baryons, and mesons and baryons together are collectively referred to as hadrons. Okay. Now, the lowest lying hadrons, again, you're very familiar with them because your life depends on it, protons and neutrons. These are baryons. So let's go ahead and start with just the lowest lying. So let's talk about light hadrons. Okay. So we've got the proton. It carries charge 1, has a mass of 938 MeV. There's a neutron. It carries charge 0, 939.6 MeV. They're very, very close in mass, which is interesting. Okay. Now the neutron, if you just separate it from a nucleus, if you pop a neutron out of a nucleus and then you watch it, a neutron will decay to a proton and an electron and neutrino with a lifetime of about 900 seconds. Okay, now that's a huge, huge lifetime. Okay, and immediately, you should be wondering, you all know that, you probably have heard before, that this reaction is a weak reaction. It occurs to the same interactions that mediate muons decaying to electrons. So why in the heck is a muon, which is, you know, 100 MeV, it's only a factor of 10 away in mass from the neutron, why is this decay 10 to the minus 6 seconds, but this decay is darn near 900 seconds? Okay. We'll come back to that. It's a little odd. This is beta decay. And as far as we can tell, protons are stable. We've never seen them decay, ever. Now, in practice, there have been quite a few searches that look for proton decay, and that's in part because we think proton decay will tell us something about the Standard Model at extremely high energy scales, close to the Planck scale. And if you look, for example, at the lifetime of, say, a proton decaying to a pion and a positron, this is larger than 10 to the 33 years. These are all situations where you're looking for the decay, you don't see them, so you translate them into statements about the lifetime of a certain decay process being longer than a given amount. Okay, and likewise, when you look at, say, invisible decays, this is larger than 10 to the 29 years, okay? But this is a very active subject of research, at least experimentally. Okay. Now, these are the low-lying baryons. There's also low-mass mesons. So these are baryons. Okay, proton and neutron. There's also low-lying mesons. The lightest of them all are these three pions. I alluded to pions earlier in the decay of the tau. But we have pi plus and pi minus. They're antiparticles of one another at 139.6 MeV. And then we have a neutral pion at 135 MeV. Okay, and it's its own antiparticle. Now, whereas there's stable baryons in the Standard Model, at least the proton is stable, there are no stable mesons in the Standard Model. All of them decay eventually through weak interactions. Some of them decay through faster reactions. So what are those? So if you look at, say, the pi plus or the pi minus, it decays essentially all of the time to a muon and a muon neutrino, the lifetime of 2.6 times 10 to the minus 8 seconds. Okay. Now, that time scale is much, much, much closer to the time scale that we saw a muon going into an electron. Okay, so that's not such a mystery. It's a little bit smaller, but maybe we shouldn't be surprised. This turns out is a scalar. The other state's a fermion, so of course you have to account for that. All of these things we'll understand in more detail later on. I'm trying to draw your attention to a few puzzling facts about some of these numbers. Now, like muons, pions are also things that, for all intents and purposes, and they might as well be stable particles, at least in laboratory experiments. When you produce these things at high energy and you give them a boost, they travel meters, tens of meters, in fact. Okay. But this is a weak decay. Now, that's at least how the pi plus and pi minus decay. But if you look at the pi zero, the neutral one, it decays almost all the time to two photons. Okay. And if you look at the time scale for that decay, it's much, much, much faster, okay? So instead of 10 to the minus 8 seconds, it's 8 orders of magnitude faster. It's 10 to the minus 16 seconds. Okay. So this is not macroscopic. This is, 25 nanometers. So why is that? So why does this one decay through weak interactions, but this other pion, which you'll see, has a natural grouping with the pi plus and pi minus. It's very close in mass. It decays to two photons. So it turns out that this is actually an electromagnetic decay. Now, I'm not mentioning all of the decays. So for example, in the pi plus, pi minus sector, there's a very subdominant decay into an electron and a neutrino. But it has a branching ratio of 10 to the minus 4. So it's very rare by comparison. Okay, so there's also but the branching ratio is about 10 to the minus 4. We'll understand why. In fact, we'll understand why this very tiny branching ratio turns out to tell us something important about the weak interactions in there and their parity structure, and also the universality of lepton coupling to weak interactions. But for now, just write it down and mentally table it away. We'll come back to that. So these are all of the strongly interacting states that account for most of what you see when you collide particles together at sub-GeV energies. Okay? Basically, if you collide protons and neutrons, or you slam an electron into a proton or neutron, you'll pop out lots of pions. You have to go to somewhat higher energies, and then you start to see a much richer array of mesons and baryons. Okay, and in fact, I could just tell you what all of these states are, and we could try to piece together how they fit together, and that's sort of a course on its own. But instead, I just want to summarize for you families of mesons and baryons that appear to be related to one another, and then I'll tell you about some of the sort of a simple way of organizing these families of mesons and baryons into multiplets. Let's see, this is the front one. So let's keep going. So these are the meson families. So I already told you about the very low-lying pions. But if you go up slightly higher in mass, you start finding not quite replicas, but other groups of mesons. Oops. Okay. So I didn't tell you before, but the first family that you run into, these are spin zero, parity odd, so we call them pseudoscalars instead of scalars. Okay. There's the pi plus, pi minus, pi zero. And at slightly higher mass, these, of course, you may remember, these are 139.6 and 135. You start to see something that we call kaons. They're at around 500 MeV. There are four of them. Okay. And then you see an eta. We call the eta and the eta prime. They're a little bit heavier. At least one of them is a little bit heavier. And then it's a little strange, but we can understand this a little later in the course, but the other one is actually much heavier. The discrepancy in mass between this guy and this guy as compared to these turns out to be interesting. Okay. There's another group of them, which instead of having spin zero being scalars, they're all vectors. They carry spin one. Okay. They're still parity odd. All right. Now, I'm going to write them suggestively, because they pair up in sort of the same way as these pseudoscalar mesons. Okay? And this is, again, this is very suggestive of the fact that these states have constituents, and all we're seeing here are excitations. Okay? So there's, we call these the rho. There's a charged rho and a neutral rho. at about 775 MeV. We give these, at least in the case of the kaons, we just call them K stars. Okay. And they're at 891. The charged ones are at 891.7, and these guys are at 896. So note that they're all a bit heavier than these scalar mesons. And then there's we call it the omega, and we call it the phi. 782.6, and this one is a little bit heavier at 119.5. Okay. Now I'll just tell you the answer. The reason there's a pair of vector states for all the scalar states is it'll turn out these mesons have two fermion constituents. And when the spins are anti-aligned, they can be in a spin zero configuration. And when they're aligned, they can be in a spin one configuration or a vector configuration. But I haven't got to the quark model quite yet. Okay, so much for the light meson families. Now, these are all in groups of nine, right? We call them nonets. Now, the baryons come in groups of 10 or 8, so octets or decuplets. And they have a very similar sort of spin structure. There's low-lying spin states, and then there appear to be what are spin excitations of them, okay? So we have... First, let me tell you about the group of 8, because the proton and neutron belong to these. So they're all spin 1/2. These carry, they are parity even. So they're the proton. First, let me just write them down. The proton, the neutron, the lambda, the sigmas. Sorry, I'll get out of the way in a second here. Okay. Okay. And then just as like in the case of, let's see, this is the decouplet. Just like with mesons, where there was a spin zero configuration and then a spin one, so we could, it looked as though all we were doing was flipping a spin half constituent to get an excitation. If there's a spin 3/2 family related to the spin half family of baryons. Okay, and let's see, do I want to write all of these out? Well, I'll do it quickly. So probably the most important here are the deltas. So one of these actually has charge 2. And then you have a whole sequence of them in the same grouping here. And they all basically have approximately that mass. There's excitations of the sigmas. Okay, and they are slightly different in mass. Okay, and we have the omega. Okay, now, there's a fairly simple way of understanding where all of this structure comes from. Okay? Which we have using the three-flavor quark model. But there's just a couple of other important facts that will be useful later on when we're talking about effective field theories that are worth mentioning for the strong interactions. I'm trying to think. I'm going to go ahead and erase this. So as soon as the neutron was discovered, so by the way, I don't know if you know the history much of this, but I mean, the proton and electron were discovered relatively early on. It took a long time to discover the neutron. And in fact, nuclear physics was hampered for years because people thought that the nucleus was built out of protons and electrons, okay? And just nothing worked, okay? But once the neutron was discovered and people started slamming particles into protons and neutrons, they started to see that the strong interactions obeyed some pretty remarkable regularities. So Heisenberg first pointed this out. Shortly after the neutron was discovered, and people started playing with them. But it really looks like the strong interactions to a very, well, nature, to a very good approximation, appears to obey a symmetry, in fact, a continuous symmetry, where you can rotate a proton into a neutron. Essentially, the strong interactions treat protons and neutrons roughly the same way. Okay. So in particular, the strong interactions respect a global SU2 symmetry. We call isospin. And that's a symmetry where if we group the proton and neutron together as a doublet, okay, I think you've seen some group theory earlier on, and then we apply an SU2 transformation, rotation matrix to this proton-neutron doublet. Okay, this is the spin 1/2 SU2 doublet. That decay processes, scattering reactions, all sorts of phenomenon and that you can study and measure in strong interactions appear to obey symmetries where if you start out with one kind of reaction and then you perform an SU2 transformation, generally what you'll do is you'll take that reaction and that will then be related to some linear combination of other reactions. Okay. So what this symmetry does in practice is it reduces the number of independent observables that you have in your theory. And so the statement that the theory is invariant under that symmetry just means that different kinds of scattering are related. So as an example, well, I should tell you how you should group the rest of the hadrons, though, into this. I told you you should treat the proton and neutron as a doublet under this symmetry. But of course, we've got pions, there's kaons, there's sigmas. How do you group them into multiplets? I'll just tell you the answer. Okay. So this is the isospin grouping. Now historically this is also why it's written these states can be partially understood to group the way they do. If you look at the pions and the rows, they are in isospin vector multiplets. Okay, so this is an SU2 global symmetry. So when I talk about how a multiplet transforms, I'm using the spin label that I'll call I, right? So you may recall, so the doublet is spin 1/2, so that's a pair. The triplet is spin 1, okay? So essentially, the three mesons have an I3, if you will, of minus 1, 0, and 1. Now, the kaons actually group into two different multiplets, but they're both doublets, okay? So there's a positively charged doublet and there's a negatively charged doublet. The sigmas group into a vector multiplet. It's a little embarrassing. Nablus? I want to say Nablus. Yeah, whatever. This guy's in a doublet. And the deltas, okay. These are in a somewhat larger isospin multiplet. They're in the three halves, okay. Now, the way this actually worked, of course, is that you start playing with these particles, you start measuring their scattering rates and their decay rates and their decay patterns, and essentially working off of the hint that you get from looking at proton-neutron scattering, seeing that it obeys some sort of isospin symmetry, you have to learn from the data how to assign these different states to their isospin multiplets, okay? But once you do, you can see, you can start making predictions, and you see that the strong interactions appear to obey a big isospin SU2 symmetry where the mesons and baryons are grouped into these following multiplets, okay? Now what this does, I'll erase this one now. Okay, so for example, if you look at decays of deltas into pions, and then we call them N states, and the N states are essentially things like protons and neutrons. They're, okay, so we'll call these N states. I'll come back to what they mean. So there's a whole series of these. And these different decays are related by SU2 Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. A better example would be imagining what happens when you take pions and, say, a proton, and you scatter into different final states. It doesn't matter what the final state is here. Just pick a final state. The point here is that the pion lives in some isospin multiplet. The proton lives in another one. If I apply an isospin transformation to the initial state, okay, and I apply the same isospin transformation to the final state, that gives me a different reaction. Okay, so I can apply an isospin transformation, and that'll give me a reaction that also involves a pion and, say, a neutron. Okay. I'm doing this very schematically here, okay? So this is a different final state, so let's call this final state prime. All right, these, combinations of these are related by SU2 isospin. Okay, so in practice, there's a whole sequence of reactions that in principle could have been independent, but when you actually measure them, you find that when you supply appropriate Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, they're all related to one another through this big global symmetry. Now, that's a big deal, okay? When you start to see particle interactions that respect this big global symmetry, you should wonder, well, where did that come from? Okay. Now, the other big deal is that you find that the strong interactions may respect this symmetry, but they are not respected exactly, okay? So an important note is that electromagnetic and weak interactions violate isospin, okay? Now, you should have guessed this because you can't say that the proton and neutron, which carry different electromagnetic charges, can be grouped into some SU2 doublet. I mean, that's just clearly at odds with electromagnetism. Treating them the same. Clearly, you know, electromagnetism clearly treats the two differently. Okay? But because electromagnetic and weak effects are small, to a very good approximation, what you see is isospin respecting dynamics, and then you see small effects, and it usually shows up in things like decays that violate isospin. Now, this isn't the only huge regularity that we see. We also see selection rules in strong interaction scattering dynamics. So, So in particular, when you start looking at what kinds of particles you can produce when you collide things like pions and protons and neutrons, you don't make arbitrary varieties of them. You find that certain kinds of particles can only appear in pairs, or they can only appear with a particular kind of, well, not just pairs with themselves, but some of them will pair up and only appear together. Okay? So there's additional selection rules. Okay? So for example, now this was, I think once people actually got a lot of data that they could look at, and this occurred in the 1950s as these mesons and baryons were being discovered and their interactions were being probed, that if you looked at things like pi zero, so this is an example, if you looked at, say, collisions of pi zero with a proton, you could make these kaons, okay? You could make kaons with delta baryons. You can make them with sigma baryons. So these are seen. But you know, look, once you start making kaons here, you might ask, well, you know, can the kaons show up with random other kinds of baryons? I mean, can they show up with anything? And the answer is no. What you don't see are reactions, for example, where you produce these, I want to say, nabla baryons. Okay? So that's not seen. And of course, if you're a theorist, and you see a bunch of reactions that do occur and a bunch of reactions that don't occur, you wonder, well, why? That's clearly a clue. And essentially, all the data could be accounted for by introducing, or by just guessing that the strong interactions respect another conserved quantum number. So in addition to a big SU2 global symmetry that it respects, it appears that the strong interactions also respect an additive quantum number that we call strangeness. Gelman, I think, introduced this term. And essentially, we take these kaon doublets, and we give them strangeness plus one. And we give the other one strangeness minus one. I'll just tell you what the strangeness assignments are here. Okay, so if you take mesons, and not all mesons and baryons, the ones I haven't written down are given strangeness zero, okay? I haven't written everything up here. The others have strangeness zero. But if we introduce the following additive quantum numbers, that can account for what appears to be a big set of selection rules that the strong interactions preserve, okay? So let me just summarize. Worry out. If you haven't finished that, I'll move this up in just a second. Okay. So let me summarize by just listing apparent symmetries that are respected by the different interactions. Now, you know, I notice I haven't even told you what the interactions are. I've just said strong, weak, electromagnetic. Now, you all know what electromagnetic interactions are. I haven't told you in detail what weak interactions are. I've only really told you what they do. And strong interactions, so far in this lecture, are just the things that bind nuclei together. And they give you scattering rates that are on the scale of millibarn. Okay. So here's a summary of clues. So there's, let's write our strong interactions, weak interactions, electromagnetism. Okay. Now, when I was listing all the mesons and baryons before, I was including a parity assignment. And you can also include a charge conjugation assignment. Charge conjugation interchanges particles and antiparticles. I didn't list it explicitly, but I know that that I believe all of these discrete symmetries are going to be discussed in tutorial tomorrow. So I'll come back to explain anything that you may have questions about after that. But you can. But part of the reason we do that for the strong interactions is that the strong interactions do seem to preserve parity. Okay, so different parity configurations are treated the same way by the strong interactions. They preserve charge conjugation. Okay, so they respect particle-antiparticle interchange through charge conjugation. So let me just list those two. So there's parity, charge conjugation. There's this strangeness quantum number. There's isospin. Okay, and just for completeness, because you may have seen it before, let me just take the combined operation of CPT, okay? The strong interactions preserve parity, and because they're strong, it's just very useful to talk about parity when you're looking at the hadron spectroscopy, because they organize themselves into states with well-defined parity. However, the weak interactions appear, and we'll get to this later, they don't respect parity. Electromagnetic interactions do. Not all of these facts have been given to you yet, but we might as well summarize them all at once. The strong interactions also preserve charge conjugation invariance. They preserve strangeness. They preserve isospin. They preserve CPT. Okay. So that's very nice. So fortunately, even though there's this big array of particles in towers of excited states, we can use quite a few symmetries to organize them and understand them. Okay, but the weak interactions are a pain. They don't respect parity. They don't respect C. They don't respect strangeness. They don't respect isospin. Okay, but they do respect CPT. And essentially, you can see this. You could take all of these symmetries, and you can look at you can go to the PDG and you can look at some of the reactions that are mediated by weak and electromagnetic effects, and you'll see that they violate parity, they violate strangeness, they violate isospin, and so on. Okay. Nonetheless, electromagnetism does respect some of these. Okay. So at the beginning of the next lecture, I want to review the quark picture. All right. Essentially, there's a picture for where all of this meson and baryon spectroscopy comes from. If we imagine that they're built out of constituent spin 1/2 fermions, three of them in total, and that'll give us a very predictive, powerful framework for understanding where these bound states come from. It'll allow us to understand what their spin configurations are, what their parity assignments are. It'll give us some idea for where this strangeness quantum number comes from. And with a little bit more work, we can start to understand why there's this big global SU2 symmetry in the strong interactions. Okay, but I think I'm going to have to save that for next time, because I think we're out of time for today. Are there any questions? Yeah?
About that CPT, that weak interactions, how good is it measured or experimented? Are we sure about it?
If CPT was broken, then Lorentz invariant would be broken.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's several ways you can answer this. This is something that you should always imagine is subject to experiment, and there are a number of experiments that do try to precisely test the combination CPT as an invariance of interactions. Okay, and we can discuss what those experiments are a little bit later, but if we just stipulate that nature is a relativistic local quantum field theory, within that framework, CPT is guaranteed to be preserved.
Yeah.
But it's not like it's a logical inconsistency. You know, it's not like everything would come crashing down if we found that CPT were violated in some experiment. That would just tell us that indeed nature is not quite a local relativistic quantum field theory, and we could try to relax some of those assumptions. We'll come back to that a little bit later, though. So I strongly encourage all of you to go to the online Particle Data Group webpage. I went through a lot of this quickly today. But if you go there, you can find many more details. And in particular, I mean, the details don't really matter, because one of the things we're going to do next time is understand how you go about forgetting all the details and still understand roughly how things work. Okay? But just, you should take a look at it once, and you'll find a nice wealth of information there. Okay, thanks.